Welcome to the Indian Silicon Valley podcast. I'm your host, Jibraj, and on this podcast, I speak with founders, investors, and domain experts from the Indian Valley, trying to understand the art of building a legendary company. In this episode, we continue the series From the Globe, and I speak to Prasanna Sankar, co-founder of Rippling. Rippling was started by Parker Conrad and Prasanna Sankar, and is one of the leading enterprise software companies in the US today, becoming the foremost platform for employee management, valued at over $10 billion as of its recent round of funding. Prasanna is a genius coder, a serial entrepreneur, an angel investor, and much more. An epitome of the entrepreneurial spirit, Prasanna embodies risk-taking, first principles thinking, and the builder's mindset like no other. Through this hour-long conversation, we decode the series of events that have led Prasanna to start companies, work with the brightest minds, manufacture serendipity, and carve out the pathway to success. From starting and shutting down companies, to taking a break, learning new skills, and most importantly, looking at things as is, and eventually taking the asymmetrical risks that define life, we cover it all. This is one of the most unique conversations I have ever had, and I can assure you that if you make it to the end, you shall leave with a transformed perspective to entrepreneurship and life. But before we get started, here is a quick word about our sponsor. This episode of the Indian Silicon Valley podcast is presented by Stride Ventures, which is one of India's leading venture debt funds, becoming synonymous with innovative startup financing in India. Stride Ventures provides comprehensive solutions going beyond venture debt to cater to distinctive challenges faced by high growth and inherently strong businesses backed by leading institutions. The fund has a portfolio of over 60 plus diversified companies, having deployed more than 1,500 crore rupees to date. In just over 2 years, Stride Ventures has emerged as the preferred venture debt lender in the Indian ecosystem. To know more about this phenomenal fund, visit strideventures.in, that is spelled as STRIDEVENTURES.IN. And with that, let's dive in to the 103rd episode of the Indian Silicon Valley podcast with Prasanna of Rippling. Thank you so much, Prasanna, for joining me. Incredibly delighted and super excited to be hosting you today.
Thanks for having me.
Great to hear that, Prasanna. And I think as we get started, I want to uncover a bunch of things, especially in terms of your journey. But I want to start with this fact about you, which is to say that, you know, you were one of the best coders, ranked one when you left the country and went to the US, right? You won these multiple championships, competitions, and I'm guessing that built your persona in a different way. Talk to us about what were those days like? How did that shape you? How did that ingrain the spirit of building in you? And maybe take us through that part of life.
Definitely. I mean, it was 100% transformative for me. You know, I mean, it built the confidence that, you know, you can go and do these things. And it was also a contrarian bet that paid off early, you know, like when, so I got my first computer when I was in my 11th grade. And, you know, initially I started sort of creating games or viruses, you know, just playing around with it. You know, it was a lot of fun. You know, I thought to myself that I'm good at it. Like, yeah, my friends sort of thought so because, you know, I was able to infect their computers and stuff, right? So, you know, I thought to myself that I was good at it. And, you know, that sort of gave a little bit of early confidence to go into this. And, you know, when I went to college, when everyone was studying for the academics and stuff like that, you know, there was these programming contests that came up. It was early, it was new. There weren't a lot of awareness about these things. So Google came out with this thing called Google Code Jam, which was fascinating. And, you know, that I felt like it was an undervalued bet because, you know, everyone, you know, their dream job in college was to work for Google. In fact, there was no way to, like, Google didn't hire at that time, you know, in India at all, actually. And, you know, it seemed like an undervalued bet, an underrated bet to just like do well in this competition and get hired, right? So that was sort of the initial motive. I also thought, you know, the competition was fun on its own terms, but it was even more sort of amplified that, oh, maybe actually, like, you know, when everyone is spending time studying their academics, this is actually, you know, this bet, even though I like it, it's actually even more, it'll also pay off. So there's the alignment of impact and interest, you know, which sort of, you know, gave into these programming contests. So I spent a lot of time on it, you know, for like 6 months or something, and it paid off. Like I was ranked one in India in Google Code Jam, and I went to the world finals. And, you know, one thing led to another, and I sort of won a lot of these programming contests, and it built a lot of confidence in me, and especially built a lot of confidence that you can, you know, world is not sort of rational. You can, you know, there are all these sort of undervalued bets that people just leave out on the table, and they sort of instead spend time on consensus bets.
Got it. No, I think it's super interesting. And, you know, I've observed this line of thought from you also, where you can almost, let's say, conspire against the universe and, you know, manufacture a serendipity in some shape or form, right? You have this entire theory around it. We'll talk about it further. But talk to us more about, you know, what was the next phase of your life? From what I know, you know, you got into Microsoft, started working there, but that didn't sit too well. And you then went on to a spree of starting companies, which were very fascinating in their own way. I think the love of building was ingrained in you, and that still portrays in some shape or form. Talk to us about how, you know, it got kindled in you. What was the first reflection of entrepreneurship inside you, and how did you follow through on those, you know, fearless bets, if I may call it that?
Yeah. I mean, I didn't really want to be an entrepreneur or anything. You know, in fact, there wasn't really a path that I saw, you know, that clearly to be an entrepreneur or anything like that. You know, my sort of heroes or idols are from this programming contest world back then. People who just were, you know, extremely smart, curious. And, you know, it so happened, like, later down the line, a lot of them also sort of became my really good friends and very successful entrepreneurs. But I, you know, we didn't know it at that time. It was all sort of a group of people who were doing, you know, like these top coders or, you know, like the programming contest crowd was like, you know, just curious people. Something new was happening. We just did this for the fun of it, and, you know, sort of like outcasts or whatever, right? So from there, my interests were just like, you know, build deep engineering, like build great systems. And, you know, that's when, you know, my first job was at Microsoft Bing. They were sort of building Bing from scratch. You know, the crawler was certainly being built from scratch. So, you know, it was code that was running on hundreds of thousands of machines. So from the outside, as a college kid, it was very, very fascinating, you know, to go and do that. Like, who gives an opportunity to a college kid to do something like that, right? So, you know, it was, at least in theory, supposed to be the dream gig that I wanted. You know, I went in there, I was like very, very enthusiastic, and like, you know, spent, you know, put in insane hours, you know, building things. Like, I remember, so my manager sent out an email saying, hey, listen, we can't, to the entire team, saying we can't launch the crawler because we have a bottleneck. Like, you know, it's just taking way too much CPU than our estimates. Like, we can't throw these many machines at the job. So we have to delay the launch by like a few months. And, you know, he said, this is the thing that everyone should be looking at, thinking about. How do we solve these problems? Right out of college, this is my first week into the job. You know, when most people are just like doing training, right? Like, you know, it's just, hey, what is the code base? You go, you sit in, like, you know, meetings after meetings. And this was after my training. In the evening, I got this email from my manager, and I wasn't even sort of assigned any projects or anything yet. So, and I was like, oh, wow. Okay. So I have an opportunity to prove myself. And, you know, I didn't sleep that night. I worked through the night, like for the next, you know, I decided, okay, in the next overnight, I'm going to solve this problem. Just hubris, arrogance, whatever, right? And, you know, I really didn't understand the code base, but I was able to check out everything. I was able to run it. I was able to profile it. And the profile sort of pointed to some problems. Like, you know, these were the problems. And I looked at the code. I understood that, you know, they're doing a bunch of heuristics, which were sort of probabilistic, non-deterministic. And if you converted them so that it's a state transition, which is order of one, you can guarantee that in order of one operations, the state will always transition, the state will always progress forward, then it would just be much faster. You know, the inner loops can all be eliminated. And that was sort of the source of the bottleneck. So I thought, okay, I mean, this is not that hard. Like, you know, I come from programming contest background. This is what I do. This is what I'm good at. So I can do this. But of course, you know, it is like super complicated. Like, it's code base that I've never seen and stuff like that. Thankfully, I was able to run it, test it. It had good tests. So sort of worked on it for the next 6 hours, 8 hours, 10 hours. And by morning it was done. Like, I mean, it was done as in the code worked. I ran a new profile on production and it was sort of, it was performing, you know, it went from 99% CPU usage to less than 1% CPU usage. So I knew that, like, okay, it has made an impact. The profile made an impact. So, you know, it was a very, very interesting and a fascinating project. I sent, you know, I was proud to write the email the next day saying, hey, listen, this is done. You know, I did it. And people were, my boss's boss was very impressed. He noticed. And he was like, okay, you know, you shouldn't do it this way, but you should do it this other way. And let's start a new project to do this the other way. Let's do it properly. And, you know, you can be a part of the 4-member team, which builds it. So, you know, again, it was a fascinating opportunity, you know, in my first week to get something like that, you know, worked very hard again for the next 3 months, 4 months. You know, build something which is super technically complex. I mean, I just had a lot of fun, like, you know, build something way more complicated than it probably needed to be, just because that's what I got in high on. You know, I didn't have any experience, you know, I just was an interested kid. And then code reviews took forever, you know, to get things into production took forever. And senior engineers rightfully told me that, like, you know, hey, this is just too complicated. Like, this is not how you're supposed to do it. And, you know, it was sort of stuck in that loop. And, you know, I felt like, you know, fuck, you know, they're taking it too chill. You know, this is sort of like a Microsoft thing, big company thing. And it sort of started, like, there was nothing for me to do other than just wait for them, you know, once a week, I'll get an opportunity for them to review my code. And, you know, I was just sitting around. So that was starting to sort of burn out. And I looked around and, you know, these were people, many smart people, many people from these programming contest circuits and so on. But 10 years they've been doing this. They've sort of like gotten married within Microsoft. You know, it was a pretty chill culture. And I always thought like, hey, listen, I've done all these things. And I felt that I'm special. You know, I'm able to sort of... And it suddenly felt like maybe my peak was behind me. And that was the scariest feeling out of it all. It's okay. Yeah, I mean, you know, I could take things chill. I could become like one of these guys. But, you know, I would always be proud of the thing that I did before this, not the thing I did here. And that was sort of the moment in time where, you know, it was clear to me that this is not what I wanted to do with my life.
I think that's super interesting. I think what I'm hearing is also this sense of, I wouldn't call it urgency, but this sense of just like, hunger in oneself, right? Like, which is very important as an entrepreneur to just like go out there and get stuff done and add this value. And I think that just entire line of thought just proves that so well. So I think incredible learnings there. But going on to the other phase, which I know is also very fascinating, right? Because you've spoken about this in the past, where early influences from people like looking at people like Mark Zuckerberg, Paul Graham from Y Combinator, other folks, I mean, A16Z invested in your first company and stuff like that became very important. If you can also take us through, you know, some of the major influences that the building journey had. And also, I'm guessing from what I know, it wasn't as successful, right? Some of these ideas didn't work out as well. So maybe what did you learn through that phase of life?
Yeah. I mean, I think when I was sort of disillusioned and I was thinking about, okay, what do I do next? Sitting around at Microsoft with nothing to do. You know, at that point, I sort of took a break and like I took a 4-month break and, you know, I was sort of exploring startups and this, there was a movement at that time called indie creation. You just sort of build something, it pays your bills. You do whatever you like, you build it for the fun of it. So I was sort of into all that. I was sort of exploring that. At the same time, I came across Paul Graham. It was just happening. YC was just happening at that time. This was like 2008, 2009. And I read his blogs and his whole point was, you know, instead of doing something that pays your bills, like startups are a tool to compress time. You can compress, you know, the rate at which you make money, the rate at which, you know, you learn, like, you know, it is just sort of, it's like going near a black hole. It just, your time gets compressed a lot. And that was fascinating to me. I mean, all I wanted to do was to make enough money that I don't need to work at all, right? Like, and I also felt like I didn't even have another choice. Like, if I need to go hungry, I can go hungry, but I cannot work at Microsoft. It's not like I'm making a risk reward trade-off or anything like that. It's just that option just does not seem viable for me. So, you know, I need to sort of find a way to make a living, I'll do things that are interesting to me and hopefully I find a way to make a living. And that's kind of where the startups was very, very fascinating to me. And, you know, I could relate a lot with Paul Graham and, you know, the way he was thinking about these things. And he was talking about a 50% hit rate of founders that he'd funded who ended up being millionaires. That's not a great outcome for him as an investor. It's not a bad outcome because he was buying stocks at like very low prices back then. It's not a bad outcome for PG, but it's not a great outcome either. But, you know, I mean, the success rates were insane. Like, you know, 50% odds for $1 million seems like I would take that. And, you know, so that got me very fascinated because without Paul Graham, like I wouldn't even know there exists such a path. And there honestly wasn't such a path at all. You know, to be honest, if you go back then, like you needed to know the VCs and it's not that true today, but it's still a little bit true. Like it's not like there is an application process on the website that you can click and submit. But PG broke that. You know, Y Combinator was an application process on the website where you can go and submit. So that was very promising and fascinating for me. And, you know, ever since that, like, you know, I just wanted to be, you know, get into that. Like, I thought it was the new thing that was happening in the world. It was a new sort of Google Code Jam that I wanted to write.
Got it. No, I think that's super. I mean, entrepreneurship is definitely the best level playing field, right? I don't think it gets better than that. I think Web3 and things, of course, you know, bridge the gap even further. But I think that's so true in terms of, I don't think there's anything better than entrepreneurship that levels the playing field like that. Like, let's talk about Like a Little, which was your first company. There was incredible scale that you end up doing. It didn't turn out as well because it wasn't a trend. And I'll let you speak about that. But, you know, what was the impact of going out there, building something, and maybe after raising venture capital money from some of the largest folks in the world, what was it like for it to not work? And when, what did you think post that, right? I mean, I also know that you took a break after that. So maybe talk about that part of life. What were your core learnings?
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, after this influence, like, I convinced my roommate to move to the Valley and start a company with me. We sort of went into Stanford, living in, you know, sleeping out of Stanford dorms where another friend was studying. So we sort of barged in and we were trying to start things. For the first year or so, we tried many, many different things. I mean, back then, Paul Graham's advice was fail fast, learn fast. We didn't get into YC. We sort of applied with something. PG met with us. Like every season, you know, our application would always make it to PG. He would sort of call and meet with us. And he would be like, dude, you guys look like smart guys, but your ideas are bullshit. And, you know, I'll try to convince him, no, this is the next big thing. And, you know, he'd say, okay, maybe another time. So we never really made into YC, but of course, PG was a huge impact on my life. And we were trying to fail fast and fail cheap. We had the money to, I mean, on Ramen, we could go on for a little while, right? From the Microsoft savings. So, you know, we were building, we were trying different things, but honestly, the ideas were really poor. Coming out of Microsoft, I don't know what else to expect, but it was, you know, fairly poor and sort of started getting better as we were sort of launching things and learning from users. But the big mistake that we were often making was we would build something, we would go to the users and we would sort of find a way to hustle and get some traction. But the moment we discover the first roadblock, the first big reason why the idea wouldn't work, we would give up and, you know, we would fail fast and fail cheap and move on to the next thing. And the next thing turned out to be something in a different segment, different market, because we just failed in this market, right? In retrospect, I realized, okay, that was the worst thing that we were doing. And we, you know, it just couldn't, no startup ever works like that. I mean, in retrospect, I know that, okay, what you're trying to build is a treasure map. You're trying to build a map where to figure out the path to the gold. Each time you hit an obstacle, you try different paths so that you're sort of like a mouse exploring a maze. You know, you remember which paths didn't work and you find more paths. And the map is actually valuable. You sort of gain accumulated experience on that map and you get clues and hints along the way. Each time you sort of restart, you lose all of that, right? So that is one big learning that I didn't know. You know, the fail fast and fail cheap was not quite true. In fact, I disagree with a lot of what PG has said and written about right now. You know, I sort of believe in, now I don't believe in the lean startup. I believe in the fat startup, which is, you know, having an opinion, you know, having a 5-year opinion about what the space should be, what the world should look like, and just going and building for it. I mean, of course, if you want to build, if you need to have a 5-year opinion, you better really know the map well ahead of time before you even start. I also sort of, you know, disagree with the PG philosophy now in retrospect of, you know, just get a smart group of people together and then you can figure out what to build. I don't think he quite said that ever explicitly. And, you know, that's sort of the reason he never funded us. But his blogs give you the impression that it's all about the teams. But actually, I don't think that at all at this point. I mean, I think the teams are very important. It is all about the team for the investor. But for the team itself, I don't think it's all about the team. It's a weird paradox. It's a weird contradiction. And startups are full of contradictions because it's sort of like a moment of singularity. It's like a black hole, you know, inside that rules don't quite exactly apply, you know, especially during founding. I mean, I think the source of the contradiction is, if you look at any successful startup, they are... they start with the idea first and the team falls in love with the idea and sort of forms around the idea. Like Elon didn't say, oh, I'm going to start a company and, you know, and then it happens to be a space company. He sort of worked with people who worked for him for free. You know, they all sort of met over nights and weekends, you know, trying to brainstorm how to go to Mars. You know, this was the Mars Society back then. You know, these were retired NASA engineers getting a high out of this. So they would sort of do it even if the idea wouldn't work, even if the odds were low. And, you know, in practice, like, you know, startups are a dichotomy all the time. Like you have to simultaneously believe you're going to completely change the world. And that is absolutely true. And you also have to simultaneously believe that you're just going to fail and, you know, startups fail. And that is life. And you have to sort of navigate both worlds at the same time. Now, to do that, you have to be sort of irrationally in love with the idea. If the worst case is taken out, which is, you know, you're going to fail and startups are going to fail and, you know, that is life. And if you're okay with it, because you just want to work on that idea, you know, you want to work on it regardless, you just enjoy doing that, then it sort of gives you the opportunity to go after it with full force. The mistake that we were doing, you know, there was three co-founders back then. The mistake that we were doing was we were smart people, but what are the odds that we all simultaneously fell in love with the same girl at the same time? It just wasn't happening. You know, I would fall in love and then the other people would say, point out all the imperfections of the girl, which there always was. And we just couldn't simultaneously fall in love. And, you know, that bad spell happening for 18 months, we couldn't in the moment figure out why it was happening. You know, it was like, oh, fuck, maybe we should suck then. If we can't build out a great startup, like that's what PG says, you know, if great teams can build out great startups. And then, you know, at that time, there was a viral app that was taking off in Cambridge. My girlfriend, now my wife, she was studying in Cambridge and she called me, you know, one of the days and said, hey, you guys can't come up with any ideas. Why don't you just copy this thing? This is taking off in Cambridge. And that's what we did. I sort of built it overnight and that was like a little, you know, and my co-founders are like, you know, okay, you know, let's try it for a week. And thankfully, that took off in Stanford that week. And it went viral like crazy. We were able to grow it faster and faster. We were able to execute well, much better than the Cambridge entrepreneur, you know, just because we've been hustling for a while and we've been in the desert for a while. And suddenly when we see traction and suddenly when we see a lot of water, we just jumped right in, like, you know, full on. Didn't care about taking a breath, right? So, you know, it was an insane ride. The Like a Little was an insane ride. You know, we sort of found a formula, a playbook by which you can sort of make it work in a campus. And we replicated and repeated the playbook across all over the US very, very, very rapidly. And, you know, within the first 6 weeks, we had 20 million page views. Within the first 6 months, 20% of all US college students were using the site. And our primary distribution channel was Facebook. People clicked on the like button and that created a Facebook thumbnail or an impression back in those days. And that's where students were discovering this thing, you know, it was clickbait before clickbait was active. We were the first clickbait, maybe. So, you know, so Zuck noticed actually, Facebook was a fairly small team at that time, like 100 people or something, few hundreds. And, you know, Zuck noticed that, fuck, this is the killer app that's taking off in Facebook and 20% of all US college students were using it. And he sent the CTO back then, Brett Taylor, to try and acquire the company. And, you know, this was when, you know, we had raised money from, like, this was when, again, like for the first 18 months or so, we tried 10 different ideas. We pitched many, many, many investors, right? Everyone who could even hear. Nobody would even listen. Nobody would even fund anything. And when this happened within a few months, like 2 months or something. Like we didn't talk to any investor because, I mean, I honestly didn't even have time to sleep, right? Like I was sleeping on the couch for 2 hours, just trying to keep the site up. Like the traffic was so insane. And, you know, we would have insane existential problems very, very immediately, right? Some kid would be like, you know, I'm going to commit suicide on the website. And like police would sort of call me up. And the police calls for every day, you know, every single day. At some point, I stopped taking those calls. And unless there was a subpoena or something, I didn't attend it. I just couldn't. Like, there was just too much happening. You know, of course, there was no time to meet investors or anything, right? They started showing up to my house. Like, you know, Sequoia came to this one bedroom weird house in Palo Alto that we were, you know, six of us were living at the time. And, you know, people showed up with pizzas and, you know, they funded it. Yeah, but that was an insane, insane ride. And that's what really got me hooked, that this is actually possible. This is sort of living life on the edge. It was horrible at that time. And I didn't even know that it was horrible. Like, you know, I was just sort of not feeling anything. At some point you're just, fuck, this is it. These are the problems. I need to handle it. There is nothing else I can think about. So that was my first taste of hypergrowth. you know, looking back, it was just just an insane drug that I'm continually addicted to. And that's what, you know, sort of defined the rest of my life, pretty much.
Super fascinating. I mean, I'm reminiscing through all the stories that you're mentioning, and it's just so interesting to, you know, see how you were able to follow through. I think there's some amount of, you know, conviction that you had to have on yourself and the team as well to just like keep trying. I mean, 18 months in as well, and then this worked, and then it didn't as well, right? But you didn't give up at any given point, and you recognize that this is okay, repeatable in some shape or form. That's what you ended up doing. So super, super interesting. And I love how you've developed these original thoughts for yourself as well. I mean, from idolizing PG, who's shaped so much of modern entrepreneurship, to developing these theories by yourself from first principles and experiences. So I think super nice. The next part of your story is definitely something that so many of us today look forward to, right? Because Zenefits happened, then Zenefits crashed, and then Rippling happened as we know it. Taking the first part of it, which is the Zenefits part, right? Like, what prompted you to, let's say, not start up again, like if I were to ask? And when that crash happened, was it at any given time when, you know, as you mentioned, was there self-doubt at all? Was it like, you know, this is not meant for me, right? Let's try something else of sorts. If you can take us through that journey and Zenefits falling down, because I'm guessing it was I think it quadrupled in valuation in like 6 odd months or something when you were there. So talk to us about that phase, if possible, Prasanna.
Yeah, so post Like a Little. So Like a Little, you know, let me sort of at least give some continuity. So, you know, Like a Little was a huge hit. We had $50-100 million acquisition offers from Facebook and Google. You know, Marissa Mayer sort of bought a new house, and, you know, she was, you know, had a housewarming party, and she invited us, and, you know, we showed up, and she was like, would you sell? So, you know, those were fascinating times. And then what started happening was, you know, we started noticing the cohorts were decaying. So like the early users were not using the site as much. And we, you know, we went into why and all that, you know, we tried a lot of, I mean, I don't want to detail on that because that's not what you asked about. So I'll just sort of summarize. The site turned out to be a fad. Users were using it, addicted to it for a little while, but not anymore after that. It's sort of similar to, you might remember Foursquare, maybe. You know, people were checking in a lot, and then, you know, they stopped being as interested about it. You know, it stopped being that cool. So then, you know, the site was sort of on a downtrend. The traffic was crashing. We knew it ahead of when it was going to happen because we saw the early cohorts decaying. So we tried to sell, we couldn't sell, you know, others noticed as well. And, you know, ultimately the site failed. We tried different ideas for the next couple, you know, year, 18 months, and nothing really worked. You know, different ideas in the same space for the same audience, the same user base. We couldn't rekindle it. We couldn't make it work. And I was super burnt out at that point. You know, at that point, founders were sort of sick and tired of each other. We hated each other. You know, you're sort of in a grind where nothing good is coming out. And we started blaming each other. So it was a toxic situation. And I decided to quit. You know, I thought, this is it. Fuck. I've tried everything. I've tried 10 different ideas, you know, failing fast, brainstorming ideas. That didn't work. I've tried copying a good idea, you know, that didn't work. Now, what do I do? What is the next idea that I can copy? Like, I don't even know. So I was tired of this. Most importantly, I was actually not even tired of failing. I was more tired of like having to put up a face to my employees, pretending that, you know, the next big hit is right around the corner. I was meeting with all my YC batchmates. You know, we later got into YC post Like a Little, right? PG called and said, dude, don't, you know, we rejected PG this time. And he was like, you know, please come on, let's do this. And we got into YC. So, you know, tired of putting up a face with all my YC founder colleagues saying like, you know, we're going to do something great, right? You know, we were Like a Little was voted as the most promising company in our batch by the YC founders. That is typically, you know, sort of a company voting by founders are sort of peer rating each other's companies, what would they want to invest in. And, you know, that is that has decent signal value, not the greatest, but it has decent signal value. Dropbox was voted as the most promising of that batch and so on. And then, you know, I was sort of trying to put up this face and I was not being authentic and I was burning out doing that. So I said, you know, fuck this. This is not for me. I mean, I failed. For a long time, I wasn't willing to admit that. I was like, you know, I burnt all my boats. I need to make it work somehow. And I then, you know, gave up on that. I stopped, you know, trying. I said, fuck this. You know, I'm leaving the valley. I also had the opinion that this place was too much group thought. I mean, it was a group of rebels who were thinking differently from the rest of the world. But I also felt they thought alike. They're reading the same, we're talking about the same Hacker News articles. We all had the same opinions. At some point, you know, this is probably not where the Six Sigma deviation companies are going to come from. I mean, it is coming from there. So it's a weird sort of paradox and a contradiction. But anyway, so I thought, fuck this, you know, I'm out. So I left. I called my girlfriend and said, you know, do you want to marry? And we got married to the sort of opposition of her parents, who are like, you're going to marry this guy who's sort of broke and jobless and, you know, pay the bills. She was like, yes. And we got married. Back then, you know, I thought this was it. You know, I'm done with this. And, you know, we went to Netherlands. She was working there. I was chilling for, you know, year, 2 years, you know, doing other interesting stuff. I was very curious about the stock markets, was investing in Indian stocks and so on. I was very curious about those things, but I thought I was done with startups. Like, it just didn't work for me. But then I sort of started, after I was fully rested, I was sort of getting hungry for some action. Things are moving very, very slow. And I was sort of reflecting on what I really wanted to do with my life. And I thought the best time in my life was during hypergrowth. You know, I thought that was the thing that I was seeking, building something raw and pure for a customer demand. The thing that sucked about being a founder, being, you know, doing startups, which really burns you out, is coming up with ideas and then turning out to be not that good, you know, like customers not wanting it. But, you know, the thing that's great about being a founder, that's great about being in startups, is when the customer really wants a lot of that product, they're literally sort of knocking your door for it. And you just don't have enough hours in the day to deliver. And that was sort of living on the edge. And that's the part about Like Little that I really loved. So I wanted to live more of that and less of, you know, pre-product market fit stuff. And, you know, I also didn't want to work on stuff where customers later change their mind, like turns out to be a fad. You know, that was sort of stinging experience for me, because what's the point of all of that, producing all that product? So I went to the other side, the dark side, you know, from consumer internet to enterprise, where there was a lot more predictability. You know, companies didn't easily change their mind. And in fact, you know, Zenefits was Zenefits sort of checked off both the boxes. It was the fastest growing company at that time. It went from zero to $50 million in 2 years in ARR. And that's the record, by the way, till date. Like, nobody has crossed $50 million in ARR faster than what Zenefits has done in 20 months, in the first 20 months of its founding. So it was growing insanely fast. And, you know, the customers were very, very, very sticky. Like, they were, in fact, calling and complaining. The NPS was insanely low. You know, they were calling and yelling, but they just didn't leave. So enterprises are, you know, typically sticky, but especially if you have a enterprise thesis where you're sort of all in one, you're replacing more than one systems in the company, it's very hard to leave. So that was my, you know, that's why I was very interested in Zenefits, because it gave me the hypergrowth experience as well as, you know, as well as in a predictable market. So that's really why I joined Zenefits as a director of engineering, to work on that. And, you know, I have great luck and great timing. You know, within a year, Zenefits imploded. The CEO got fired. you know.
Yeah, no, I think this is fascinating. I think the fact that you were able to, I don't know, self-reflect at the time and make those conscious choices and still, you know, fulfill your hunger of joining the hypergrowth stage is something that is super fascinating. Before we go on to, you know, Rippling, I want to touch upon the fact that you wrote a mail to Parker, right? And I mean, you were one of the three people who wrote that mail. And I was super fascinated with that journey, right? Because I mean, that point in time, as you have also said in the past, you know, defined so much of what you did post that. And it seemed very intuitive to you, but you were one of the only three people out of, like, I guess 2,000 odd people who ended up writing that email, right? Talk to us about what that kind of, you know, an action means to you, right? If you can give us just context to that particular thing, because I think it's a super inspiring, I mean, thought, and it could be revolutionary for so many people. I mean, anybody watching for that matter, right? So if you can just talk about that before we go into what Rippling was like, I think it'd be really nice.
Yeah. I mean, I think the theme that really touches me again and again and again, and I think this is true of our life, is basically there are certain days that are just, you know, there are probably like less than 10 or 20 days in your entire life that matter to how successful you are. There are 100x moments. Those days were just like, you know, are just extremely important. You just don't know which one they are. But, you know, I think it's super important to develop the skill to recognize one when you have one, and to be able to act on it, to be able to grab it, you know, fully. Right. And that has been a theme that has touched me all over my life. You know, when I was an investor, you know, when I was taking a break, you know, when I sort of left my job at Microsoft to go to the Valley, you know, there are always the, and, or like, you know, when I, you know, did the Google Code Jam, there are always like, you know, some days where it just matters a lot. And we live in an age where we have infinite leverage. We're not like farmers where every day you need to water the plant, otherwise the plant will die. It's sort of like, oh, today if you don't water it, tomorrow you can water it. We don't live in that age anymore. We sort of live in an age of infinite leverage and asymmetric opportunities. You know, suddenly one day is just too important. And, you know, and all my life, the theme has always been to be able to identify it and exploit it. And, you know, you get more and more confidence that your identification is right as you sort of get success doing that, right? You know, in Topcoder or Google Code Jam or whatnot. So when Zenefits imploded, when the CEO was fired, this is what I saw clearly without a doubt that nobody even seemed to understand was the company's over. Like, it's over. Doesn't matter that it's sort of, it was valued just now at $4 billion. It's a stop loss. The momentum has dried out and it's going to fail. And that was very clear to me because from an investor perspective also, like, you know, kind of from an ex-founder, from an investor, you sort of bring in a lot of perspectives. You kind of know that like a tech company, whole market cap is predicated on the profits it's going to make 10 years out. Like it's going to lose money for 10 years and like then it's going to make money. So you really sort of, when you're sort of buying into a tech stock, you're really buying 10-year futures, 10-year call options. So you're like, when the founder is gone and you're taming down the ambition of the company because the company is burning too much money, because you know, you want to sort of consolidate, you know, your edge is gone. Like, you know, it significantly materially re-rates the valuation, maybe probably by a 10x, right? And all our stocks are underwater. I mean, sure, you know, you could have wishful thinking, but that is sort of the truth of the nature. And it is like nobody else sort of saw it that way. You know, they thought like, yeah, sure, one guy is gone out of 2,000 people. Like, you know, what does it matter? You know, in theory, yes, if you can maintain the culture, if you can maintain the roadmap, for sure. And maybe, you know, if you sort of, if there are other people who know the treasure map as intimately, then sure. But the problem is in that company, only the founder CEO knew the map. He had the intimate experience. Even the CTO wasn't, you know, didn't have the experience personally. So I thought the company is done. It's fucked. So, you know, there is no point in continuing. And I was the odd man out. And it was weird to me that I was the odd man out in that. And, you know, so, and I also worked with the CEO before and personally in my job. And, you know, he was a great guy. He really knew the treasure map. Like I felt like, you know, I would test him. I would have these insane sort of tests and like conversations with him saying, you know, I would say, hey, I came up with this great idea. Like we were in the insurance brokering business. So I said, hey, I sort of looked at the data and we have virtual monopolies in these areas. We could charge whatever the fuck we want to be the broker. We can decide the winner in those places. So let's charge and extract more revenue from that. And Parker would sort of tell me why we shouldn't do that. You know, why that's not the game. Because if you do that, then you're sort of selling your customers and you're not really working for the customer, not being the cheapest provider at that point. And his vision was like way larger than being the insurance broker. It was to sell a lot of different other software to the customer. It was like, you know, the app, building the Apple App Store equivalent of enterprise software. So we shouldn't do that. So this seems like a good move. The first move seems good. You know, you get some material pieces, but it's a long-term blunder. That sort of areas on the chessboard, you know, he was able to so clearly see. And, you know, I thought he was the guy. Like, and it was also like, it's obvious to me that it was a huge opportunity to go found a company with them. It was the Silicon Valley way of getting a promotion, you know, which is to go from an employee to a founder, right? So there was a promotion opportunity where, you know, where everyone else in the world is going, asking their boss, begging for a promotion. You know, this was the way to get a promotion. So, I mean, again, from first principles, like, you know, you have a company which could be worth hundreds of billions of dollars, you know, Zenefits was worth $4 billion at that time. And it had like super small market share, right? Like, you know, if you're able to get 50 million in ARR, you're just skimming the cream of the cream of the cream of the market, right? Tiny portion of the market. So, you know, here you have a $100 billion opportunity that's imploding for like random reasons, for self-goal reasons. You just grew too fast or like, you know, execution reasons, right? It's imploding. And you have a treasure map that nobody is going after. And that's kind of insane to me. Like, I mean, it's like a $100 billion bill lying on the floor that nobody's picking up. And that was, I mean, obviously I sort of tried and competed to pick it up because one, I was unemployed. I don't have a job. My stock just crashed, you know? So, I mean, I'm employed on paper, but like, fuck it. I'm walking out right the next day. Two, does it matter whether you're unemployed or not when there's a $100 billion bill to be picked up? What the fuck? So I wrote Parker an email saying, hey, listen, I know you're going to start another company. I want to join you. And he wrote an email back saying, no, I'm done. You know, fuck this company building thing. I'm gone to Europe now. Bye-bye. And he left. And I wrote back immediately, you know, saying, hey, you're going to start a company. I want to join you. And he's like, okay, talk to you later. Bye. So he went to Europe for a month. And then there was a lot of disparaging articles about him, how everyone blamed him for the failures of Zenefits. And the new management blamed him. The investors blamed him. And he was under a non-disparagement clause, like legal clause, which didn't let him share his side of the story. And the only way, you know, and then he was burning inside and he was like, fuck, I'm going to start a company. So so he wrote an email back saying, yeah, actually, I'm going to start one. Do you want to join? And I did. And, you know, so the interesting anecdote about the $100 billion bill lying on the floor is actually there are only three other people who wrote that email to Parker. And, you know, I would have predicted that number is way higher because, you know, it was an insane chance. Everyone should be fighting for it, right? There were 2,000 employees at Zenefits. And, you know, when Parker was at Zenefits, everyone was clamoring for his time. Like, you know, if you could meet Parker on the hallway, he's the hero, right? You're trying to talk something there. Like, so why wouldn't you write that email? It's kind of insane. It is almost like they just forgot. Or it's like that position, that CEO position was the guy that they wanted to be friends with, or like, you know, they thought they were respecting. So, you know, Silicon Valley is in some ways a depressing, hollow world. I mean, it's not Valley. It's more pronounced in other parts of the world more than the Valley. You know, it's the fascination with just the power. But anyway, you know, Parker was a king one day and the next day nobody was even writing that email. So three people wrote that email to him saying, you know, they wanted to found it with him. And, you know, I was the best of the three. I got picked. I'm glad that, you know, I was the right guy for that time. And, you know, I'm a billionaire for that, right? Like, you know, I'm worth many billion dollars because of that. But the more important thing that I always tell people, the lesson from that is actually a little more different. It's more like the interesting question is what happened to the other two? The two guys who didn't get picked, they're founders of companies. Those companies are worth hundreds of millions of dollars today. So it's not that, I mean, like you're not really opportunity constrained as well. Like there is enough serendipity happening in everyone's life for people who decide to try interesting things. They tend to find interesting things. So it's not like, oh, if not for Rippling, you know, still these guys are successful, you know, because they're able to see things as it is. You know, they're able to see things bare. They don't have a lot of expectation of continuity or inertia that, like, you know, everyone seems to have.
I think that's more deep than you're making it sound, because there are a lot of ingrained things there which are not as often practiced, I'd say. But as you said, you know, you have to get down to the basics and look at things simplistically. And if you were to do that, you would more often than not be able to see the end goal. And I love that episode and how it played out, and so glad the way it did. But, you know, just going further and coming to a couple of core company building lessons, right? Because I'm guessing Rippling, I mean, it's worth billions of dollars now. It's grown incredibly fast. It's created a niche for itself and been a category disruptor. When you've seen this sort of scale, right, and you've seen the journey from 0 to 1, 1 to 10 and 10 to 100 now, talk to us about what that's done to your building style now, right? With all the bumpy journeys, there was this final journey which was flowing like really, really well and was so smooth. So talk to us about, you know, what were the impactful lessons that you gained as, you know, the co-founder of this large company in the Valley, which was at the center of everything that was happening. You raised from the right set of investors, great team, and everything was growing well. So maybe give us a flavor of that.
Yeah, I mean, I think Rippling is a weird company, is an exception to a lot of startup rules. And that's one of the things that you get to do when you're doing the same thing the second time around, because you know what went wrong and you can exactly go and fix those things, right? One, it was a fat startup. It was not a lean startup. Zenefits was a lean startup. It came out of YC, and right out of YC, you know, it started in YC. It went from zero to $1 million in YC, in ARR in YC. So, you know, it did everything, you know, do things that are unscalable. It did everything that sort of PG preaches just on steroids, right? And, you know, just a little bit of background, like, you know, before that, Parker was also in a desert. He was a failed startup founder for many years, 7 years, 8 years. And when he found water, which is distraction with Zenefits, he obviously binged on it. And, you know, it created a lot of, you know, unhealthy stuff, you know, which is more like, you know, just like growing pains, right? So he sold the product way before the product was great. So it had insanely low NPS. It was more a sales machine than a good product machine. And he wasn't slowing down. He was accelerating, even knowing that. In my opinion, that was the biggest blunder at Zenefits, you know, just not trying to slow down and fix things, just like accelerating. And then it led to all kinds of pains. Like, you know, when you're growing that fast, like, you know, you hire mediocre people, you hire a lot of people, they don't know what they're doing. We would have customer support tickets queued up for like 6 weeks without someone solving them. Because yeah, we're going to hire a lot of agents and that's going to solve the problem, right? Not really. The agents, you know, start their job and they ask a question to engineering and then engineering is the bottleneck now. So you need to hire a lot of engineers to answer these questions, right? Not really. The engineers don't know how to answer that question. So it all needs to go to the same person who would have already answered that anyway, directly to the customer. Now you have two levels of indirection, which is there is support agents, there is junior engineers, and then it's still going to the same guy anyway. And, you know, there are all these people just pinging each other. Like there is ping bouncing that's happening. That's useless. Computers are just sending messages to each other, but, you know, it is not solving. It's a loop. So all those things you kind of learn the hard way that, oh, fuck, you know, it seemed like a good solution at that time, but it's not working. It actually drastically worsened things. So the thing that we learned from that is like, you know, of course we had to build a great product. We knew that from day one. We also knew that your rate at which you build slows down a lot once you have customers, you know, because, or more importantly, once you have hyper growth, because you're just, you know, stuck servicing your clients, right? You can't really sort of build new products or stuff like that. So, you know, it's mostly like what you build on day one is pretty much defines what the company is. So we knew what a lot of customers at $50 million in ARR wanted. And it was a broad engineering challenge. It was like, you know, an all-in-one system, which is, you know, building a payroll system, building an HR system, building an IT management system, you know, like how do you manage computers? How do you provision computers? How do you sort of install antivirus automatically, remotely? And it was just like all these different pieces that we had to build. Each alone was a standalone, like $10 billion or $100 billion company, like every single one piece that I spoke about, right? And we were saying we were going to build it all. And it was just like me and Parker in the beginning. So it was a sort of a really ambitious task. So the biggest challenge was engineering. The biggest risk was actually engineering, which I was able to underwrite better than anyone else because, you know, I built payroll at Zenefits. It seemed insanely hard. You know, it seemed like, you know, the only competitors were like, you know, 7 years out in building payroll. And, you know, we were able to build payroll in 3 months, right? Like, you know, in the beginning, I said, it can't be done. And then when I went and due diligenced and looked at different payroll systems, I learned how it's done. And we sort of launched something in 3 months. So, you know, I had the confidence that actually, you know, like, this could be done. I could underwrite that engineering risk. And I was able to sort of convince really smart ex-founders, engineers, great engineers to, you know, tell them. So Parker had the idea map around like what customers wanted. And I really had the engineering map of exactly how this could be done, which is not like an impossible challenge. Why is it not an impossible challenge? I think that was the insight. And I had that map. So, you know, we were a great team together. We were able to put together, convince ex-founders, you know, great engineers to come take a chance on us, to join us. And we were able to convince them this would make them insanely rich, which it did. They're all insanely rich now. And we were able to, you know, go out and build that.
Got it. No, I think that's fair. And I love the fact that there was so much clarity this time. And that I think really stands out and goes to the fact that, okay, if you can iterate on top of your mistakes, I mean, the conventional saying, there's so much that can be done. And the fact that this was contrarian, but it still worked out. I remember you mentioned in the past that, you know, you raised, I think, 10 million off the bat without a product and stuff. And then you were able to carve out like what was 18 months down the line that you needed and build it out. So I think a lot of core lessons there. I think on an overall basis, what I would love to also know is, you know, now that you are, if I'm not wrong, in the next phase of your life, what prompted this decision, right? I'm guessing everything was going fine. Everything was working out well. Talk to us about your mind space as to, you know, what was the hunger still there and what did that do to you? And where are you in your current phase of life? I think that'll bring us to a great circle.
Yeah. So, I mean, Rippling was going great and I didn't think, you know, I would do any, you know, I would sort of ever leave it, ever quit. The thing that happened was, you know, my day was just full of meetings. Once I started having hundreds and hundreds of reports, the best use of my time was just, you know, meetings, which I didn't fully enjoy. I wasn't a particularly great manager or anything like that. Like I've never managed a team of more than 10 people. Before that, like, you know, at Zenefits, maybe I had 25, but I wasn't good at my job. Like I was not a good manager, you know, so I was way past what I knew how to do. And also like what I thought was interesting, you know, but I had a lot of lessons. I learned a lot of lessons there. I would always get frustrated why that person didn't act the way I would have acted. I would get like pretty frustrated, you know, as the company was growing bigger, people didn't sort of have the same incentives that I did. And, you know, and that was an expectation that I had on every hire, which worked well till 25. In fact, if I didn't have that expectation till 25, the company wouldn't have been as successful. I would go and confront people. But then that just stopped working after a certain size. And also, like, you know, I didn't know how to sort of create a culture or like set a playbook. I sort of like learned that on my job and I wasn't particularly good at it. So, you know, what actually happens as a company grows bigger is everything mean reverts. Okay. So, you know, you start off with very opinionated views and then the views of your company. So it's almost like taking a concentrated stock position. And then, you know, as you hire a lot of people, the views of the company just mean reverts into S&P 500. It's just like the best practices from everywhere. And you can't really fight that. It is going to happen in any company. But I didn't know that what you could do instead is you could pick a few things that you want to keep, a few things in which we will not mean revert. You have to codify those things. You have to like be sort of document those things and be explicit about those things and share the first principles thinking on why we should not mean revert on those things, why it's the right thing for our market and our business. Like, I didn't know that. Like, you know, I didn't know those tools, higher level leverage tools existed back then. I mean, it was a learning for me. And I was also continuing to run the company like it was a startup. So I was sort of running things close to the edge. It is like driving a Formula One race car at 100 miles per hour. And you're just like hoping that you won't hit the edges. Or, you know, in fact, I had the opinion that it's okay to hit the edges once in a while. I can sort of rebalance the rebound. And I was driving it like that. I don't think so. That one, you know, Parker didn't like that, you know, because this is his, you know, he sort of failed 3 times and he was fired 3 times. Crashing that Formula One race car. That is the reason why he was fired from Zenefits. Doing exactly that. And in fact, you know, he was so depressed. I mean, Parker sort of was a cancer patient and he, you know, he sort of survived it. He almost died there and he sort of started Zenefits. And, you know, while he was having cancer, it was supposed to be his last thing that he's, you know, that he's doing. And, you know, Zenefits failed and he was still living and, you know, it was super depressing. He was contemplating suicide at that time. You know, he was going through a lot, right? And when rippling is working and when I was driving the car like that, you know, he just couldn't take it. So he was like, fuck, you know, you're not the right guy to run this. Let's get someone. And I was like, you know, annoyed about it, angry about it, unhappy about it in the beginning. And then, you know, we did it. And I still didn't think I was going to quit rippling or anything. You know, I thought, and Parker was like, hey, listen, you're good at 0 to 1. Go start another project. Do whatever. You know, I'll fund $50 million. You know, let's do something ambitious. And I was like, okay, let me take some time off before I do something like that. And in that time, I sort of realized, okay, I do like riding the car like that. And I want to sort of do it in my own terms. And I want to see if I can do it. That's what's challenging for me. I mean, even if I do something great at rippling, I would always be like, yeah, I mean, it would have worked anyway. Anyone else could have done it as well. And it would have worked anyway. So I was like, what are the upsides of doing it at rippling? Yes, sure. You could sort of fund it with $50 million on day one. And I kind of realized, okay, maybe if I start something on my own, I could fund it with $50 million on day one as well. So for me, I mean, I think there was this question of like, is my peak behind me? Is rippling my best thing ever? Likely that it might be true, actually. You know, rippling is probably a multi-$100 billion company at this point. I mean, it's sort of on the track to do that. It is possible that, you know, that's the best thing that I ever created. But I would like to think, you know, I would like to sort of live in a world where I look forward to, you know, building something and making an impact. And I want to see, you know, if I can do it my way. And also, you know, at the same time, I also fell in love with crypto. I've always been a long-term, philosophically very, very aligned with crypto. You know, I bought my first Bitcoin in 2013, post like a little when I saw the Bitcoin paper. And I've been sort of very aligned with crypto for a long time. But, you know, I thought there was not an opportunity to build there. I did not think there was an opportunity to be a builder in that. I thought currencies were a network effect game, you know, winner take all game. And Bitcoin was it. It is just a fascinating thing. But then, you know, I was taking a break. It was obvious to me that was not true. I had made a bunch of assumptions, bunch of strong opinions about why my thesis that Bitcoin is going to be the winner. All of them were already wrong. I was able to see that. And I thought, fuck, you could actually build the next Bitcoin. And, you know, the next Bitcoin was already Ethereum. And, you know, there is already competition for the next Ethereum. And you could actually build the next big thing. This is sort of fast moving, evolving space. It was like the internet. And I thought, you know, what am I doing with my life? This is where I want to be. And, you know, I just fell in love right then.
Got it. No, I think, again, I feel it's a very humble perspective to being as self-critical as one could possibly be, and then accepting what the roadmap follows, and then just like following your inner drive. And I think that's been the constant theme that I can see. And it's just phenomenal how many 0-to-1 journeys you've taken successfully now. And I'm hoping that, you know, the next one also pans out like everybody else will. So I think wonderful to hear this. I think, Prasanna, this has been one of the most fascinating chats I've ever had. And as we bring this to a close, I would love to touch upon one is, you know, just as, you know, this is called the Indian Silicon Valley podcast, and I firmly believe that India will be the next frontier for global technology as it has been. Since you've also been, you know, speaking to a bunch of folks from India, mentoring them or either talking to them, interacting with them in some shape or form, if you had to give us, you know, some things that are maybe exclusive to the Valley and that have shaped your perhaps building process, and maybe what are the signals, early signals of what you're seeing come out of India, I think that would be super impactful.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, all my life, you know, all these years of building companies, the one thing that has been constant is my bet on India. Like every time when I hired, either from Like a Little or Zenefits or Rippling, we always had, you know, almost the majority of the engineers came from India that I personally hired. And Rippling, the employee number 3, was the head of India. We made that hire at employee number 3. For the new company that I'm starting, 0xPPL, 0xPeople, the team is entirely in India. I'm actually personally moving to Singapore, and I'm not hiring anyone in the Valley. I'm just not hiring this time zone at all. So I've been very, very long in India. To some extent, you know, the big thing was like, you know, big thing is like Indians don't sort of appreciate equity as much. So the guys I hired in India, I mean, of course, the head of India is sort of very, very rich. I mean, he appreciates equity. He came from the Valley. But the thing that Valley brings is actually just belief. Slightly zooming out, like, you know, if Indians need to understand one perspective, which they do, and, you know, a lot of them are in the Valley, and, you know, a lot of them are very wealthy. You know, the framework, the big sort of macro framework is like, okay, what is the rate limiter for progress of humanity or the progress of the world itself? And, you know, is the rate limiter talent? I don't think so. There are very, very, there are lots of smart people in the world. And is the rate limited access? Maybe, but not really. Like, you know, you can access people if you sort of knock at it, right? Is the rate limiter capital? Again, not really. Like building technology is like super cheap. You know, it's not that expensive. So in my experience from the Valley, I think the rate limiter is actually belief and conviction. And this is what, like, you know, people sort of bring into the table again and again and again. And this is what you sort of see at the highest level, you know, the games at the highest level. I mean, I'll tell you a very sort of personal story that I sort of really learned. So I met with Sam Altman. He came to my house for dinner one day, and, you know, he was talking, I was asking him, I mean, he got rich and then he's founded OpenAI, and OpenAI was the thing that he was funding. He put in $10 million, you know, when he was worth a few hundred million, like a significant number for him to start it, hired the smartest engineers. And he didn't know what was going to come out of it, but he sort of believed that this was the most important thing to work on. And he sort of demonstrated that belief and conviction by putting in enough that it hurt, that it mattered. And, you know, I thought that was a class move until he told me the story that he sort of met Elon Musk. You know, they're going to meet Elon, and they have a team of 10 engineers. And Elon was like, fuck, this is what matters to humanity. I mean, like, they were talking about nonprofit. They were talking about, like, you know, a lot of things, you know, maybe this will work, maybe that'll work. I mean, Elon knew 1/10 of what they all knew from a domain perspective, but he was like, this is obviously going to work. This is obviously going to change humanity. And here, like, you know, if you don't believe this, like right now, if you're not willing to work every working hour, quit right now. And I believe in this, and I'm writing a $50 million check right now at a $500 million valuation. Now, like, I'm stunned hearing that. Like, you know, Elon could have, you know, nobody was giving that company $50 million. You know, it's literally like, you know, a few months into founding. There is no fucking way anyone has given them $50 million. And, you know, even if you were, you could have put in that money at $200 million valuation instead of $500 million valuation. You would have owned. And that would still be like insane. That would still be an insane demonstration of your belief. So it is almost like uneconomical. Like, it is more like, fuck, I believe this thing. Like, I'm willing to bleed. Are you willing to bleed? it's a game of sacrifice. You know, it's a game of collective belief, collective disillusionment, collective illusionment, whatever you may call it. And that is the motor that runs humanity, that creates change in the world. And, you know, Indians often sort of lose out on just not believing in the equity. It's an unfortunate market dynamic that is changing these days. You know, they're seeing people getting rich and all that. But if there's one takeaway, that's kind of what I would say. If you look at all my life, you know, I was always very, very rich on paper. Like all through, you know, through Like a Little, through Zenefits, through Rippling. And I'm still very, very rich on paper. You know, on paper is the key part. And I always just believed in the paper, even though it repeatedly went to zero.
Got it. No, I think that's a key learning, right? I mean, I think belief partly, as you mentioned, right, comes from seeing a lot of demonstrated success, which is starting to happen in the ecosystem. But until then, I mean, it's the early believers that also have to take that kind of downside risk, right? Which may be limited because the upside is unlimited. But I think that belief definitely matters. I think very, very cool learning there. This has been fabulous. I truly admire the candidness with which you've spoken here and the fact that you shared such personal anecdotes with us. I think as we close it down, I would love to, I mean, just reflect very quickly on your personal traits, like let's say removing startups and building journeys from your life. If you had to just express to us, how have you evolved as a person, right? To maybe what you were like 10, 15 years back when you were, you know, starting to code to what you are now. I mean, it's also amazing how young you are in the journey, and there are a lot of glorious years left. If you had to talk about, you know, just the qualitative ends of what entrepreneurship does to a human, I think that would be a super vent to what has been a phenomenal conversation, Prasanna.
Yeah, I mean, I think it does a lot of good things, a lot of bad things. See, the thing that you sort of realize in entrepreneurship early on when you're young, you know, when you're going into these things is you kind of realize, okay, you're the odd man out. Like the world is living on a bunch of frameworks. A lot of them are just bullshit. You know, nobody's picking the $100 billion bill on the street. And then you're able to see things bare, right? You're able to just look at things, you know, you don't have, you know, that much self-doubt that other people, you know, you might be missing what other people know. You sort of almost err on the side that you actually know and other people don't know. And sometimes it does come full circle. Like, you know, at some point you kind of learn, you know, there are some upsides to living within frameworks that other people do have. To a lot of entrepreneurs, like relationships could be sort of a little bit irrational. Like, why are you sort of making a bet that it will pay off down in the line? You know, maybe when you're sick, you know, he'll sort of some relationship you've invested in, you know, that relationship will take care of you. Like, why are you making that bet? Like, you know, first, are you going to be sick? What is the statistical odds that you would need that person? And then, you know, would you feel good about, like, you can ask all these questions, and you sort of, when you're sort of young, you want to reason from everything from first principles. And as you get older, and you can see that in Parker, you can see that in the PayPal mafia, you can see that in, you know, a lot of these people as they sort of get, you know, Paul Graham, as they get older, they sort of mellow down. And the thing that they realize is, okay, you know, there are certain things actually, like, you know, like relationships and stuff, they only pay out over long periods of time. And in those things, actually the world, the common man knows more than we do, because societies have sort of like encoded those things, you know, how to approach those things. And then the short-term trade-offs, the adrenaline trade-offs that you make also shows up on your body and your physique and your health. You know, Parker is going through some of that right now. Like, you know, I mean, many, many years of hypergrowth creates very fat people. Like if you look at Drew Houston post-founding Dropbox, you know, he was just, you know, you could see he was super obese. And you can see Reid Hoffman, you know, the author of the Blitzscaling book. So, I mean, there is a lot, there is also, you know, you sort of, as you get older, you also appreciate actually some of the consensus ideas are actually pretty good. Yeah, you can have a family, you know, there is something there. Yeah, you need to, you know, be reasonable with your body. You sort of push it to the limit and you have to learn for yourself. But so, I mean, I think there is also, you know, some appreciation for some parts of consensus, which is not that interesting because most people are anyways appreciating consensus. So it's sort of only interesting to a tiny segment of repeat entrepreneurs or whatever. But yeah, I mean, I think the entrepreneurship thing, what it does essentially is you kind of like live naked. You're sort of like, you know, Neo in the Matrix, who suddenly seen a lot more than he's supposed to see. Now he can't go and pretend to live in that simulation anymore. You know, the things that he does in the simulation are not fun anymore. Like one of the most exhausting things when I was running the company was, you know, people would come up to me and ask for career advice. And like, you know, you're asking me for career advice. Do you realize that I particularly don't value any career whatsoever? Like, you know, and I now think lowly of you because you asked me for career advice. I mean, of course, I can't say this, but you know, there is that inherent paradox. Yeah, I mean, it's very hard to sort of wear clothes once you live naked.
Well, I think that's, again, I think as I was hearing you also, a lot of food for thought, right? Because I think this is best understood, then practiced, and then iterated upon. But a lot of core learnings there. And I love the fact that there's been a sense of innate ambition and innate, you know, fearlessness and living on the edge, as I would like to summarize it. But this has been a fabulous conversation. Thank you so much, Prasanna, for being an absolute candid self and sharing with us what your journey has taught you. I think a lot of core learnings for young builders out there who are looking at defining the next decades of their life. And I think all of these thinking principles are going to be super helpful. So very wholeheartedly, thank you so much for your time. And this was a pure honor, as I mentioned at the start. And this 1 hour and more has been testament to.
Thanks for having me, man. Cheers.
Awesome. With that, we come to the end of this conversation. Thank you so much for tuning into the episode. I really hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. If you're finding value with the podcast, do follow it on the audio streaming platform of your choice, drop in a review, and subscribe to our WhatsApp newsletter to get all the updates directly on your inbox. Thanks again! I will see you next week for another episode. Till then, I hope you recall. If you never try, you'll never know. Stay tuned and keep building.